Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. As Mark was just reflecting in the weather forecast, it is summer in the city still, and maybe we're all showing a little more skin than at other times of year. Well, our next guest says that how much we reveal and in what context are not just matters of politeness or style, but of constitutional law. Ruthanne Robeson is a constitutional scholar and professor of law at the CUNY School of Law. In her new book, Dressing Constitutionally, she tells us how the law dictates who is allowed to wear what and when and why. Ruthanne, Professor, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
So we'll take calls in a minute on people's run-ins with authority of any kind over what they were wearing. And actually, listeners, you can start calling with that at 212-433-WNYC. But to the title of your book, Dressing Constitutionally, what does the Constitution have to do with clothing? Aren't we allowed to wear whatever we want as a matter of free speech?
Well, one tends to think that it's about free speech or free expression, but I would suggest that if you went outside without your clothes on, you would quickly find that you would probably be arrested for indecent exposure, and you would probably not have a First Amendment claim as to that arrest. There are lots of different ways in which then the law polices, to use that word, or regulates what we wear, both directly in terms of a direct arrest, or more indirectly what we find for sale in the store, for example, all things like that.
And on the other side of the spectrum, we need go no further from the headlines than Bradley Manning, the U.S. Army private who was, of course, convicted of leaking classified documents. When he was first detained, my understanding was he wasn't allowed to wear clothing. You familiar with that?
Yes, absolutely. And so one of the things that happens and happened to him, and I think happens in prison somewhat regularly, is for him he was denied clothes. First, he was only allowed to have his underwear, and then even that was taken away from him. One of the government's justifications for that was that he was on suicide watch. But even the psychiatrist from the government itself said, no, that was not true. And in thinking about that case, so it wasn't just about him having to sleep without clothes. It was also him having to salute and in the morning salute and be kind of ready for the day while standing in the nude.
And in your book, you write about forced nudity being used in different prison settings. How common is it?
It's a little unclear as to how common it is. And we did see it, obviously, in Abu Ghraib. And we've seen it in different kinds of places. So suicide watch would be one kind of interrogation. And people use clothes as a ego down sort of notion. And it really is a way of dehumanizing people. People talk about it, making them feel like animals, especially when other people are dressed.
Also just to discipline people or not really?
It seems like, yes, to discipline people and to then say, and sort of as a carrot, if you do this, then you can have certain clothes. You
can
have
that ever been tested in court? I mean, even if you uphold forcing people to be nude for interrogations as protected, I don't know if it is or not.
Not so much.
If it's just done for disciplinary reasons as a punishment, has that ever been challenged as cruel and unusual punishment under the Constitution?
It has, and there's been mixed results with that, and often it's challenged with something else, right? So that the prisoner was forced to be nude and the temperature was cold or some other sorts of things. You know, there's usually a bunch of different circumstances that are happening at the same time.
And getting back to Bradley Manning for a minute, Manning released a statement, I think just this morning,
yes,
saying he identifies as a woman and wants to live the rest of his life as Chelsea Manning. Now, will this be an issue in terms of what clothes he might choose to wear in prison?
Yes, absolutely. So prison is really remains one of the most sex-segregated places in society in terms of regulations about clothes, about hair length, about all manner of grooming.
And listeners, have your clothing choices ever gotten you in trouble? Have you ever been sent to the principal's office or lost a job because of the way you were dressed? What about on the beach or while walking down the street? Maybe some of you have even been arrested for dressing a certain way. Have you ever gotten tangled up with law enforcement over your fashion choices? Give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Never on the show has the term fashion police been taken so literally as we talk to Ruth Ann Robeson, law professor at the CUNY School of Law, with her book, Dressing Constitutionally, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Turning to more local law, I guess we could start with topless laws. Many people think that women are allowed to go topless in New York City. Is that true?
It's a little unclear. There's a case by our highest court in the early 90s that talks about allowing women to be topless, and that was at a protest, and then saying that this law did not or the criminalization was only about topless waitresses. And so it's a little unclear in terms of the kind of speech that's involved, whether it's going to be commercial speech, whether it's going to be at a bar, whether it's going to be in terms of a protest. And so someone needs to test that law, I think.
A woman recently made news for trying to go topless at an East Village restaurant.
Right.
So are the rules different if you're in a private establishment?
It's a little unclear. It's really being litigated right now.
Well, guess what? Our lines are instantly full. So let's talk to some of our callers. 212-433-WNYC. George on the Upper East Side. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Okay.
Good. Well, I have two instances. My daughter went to a Catholic school. And she took her clothes off at school, you know, and she was used to taking her clothes off. She's a little girl. She was just his first day in school, I think. And she took her clothes off, and, she got expelled. They threw her out of school. She said they said she couldn't come there anymore. And I was really surprised. I mean, as a young, you know, she was a five-year-old girl. And she'd been, you know, taking her clothes off to take baths, to take showers, to, you know, nudity was not a problem for her.
You mean she got to school and she thought, like, oh, I'm here now. I can, you know, kick back, so I'm taking off my clothes.
Yeah, she just decided that she didn't want to wear the dress that she was wearing, so she took her clothes off.
5 years old. George, thank you very much. Ginger in Princeton. You're on WNYC. Hi, Ginger.
Hi. I'm calling about an incident that happened to me when I was in junior high school in Park Ridge, Illinois. It was 1962, and kilts, wool kilts, were popular in the fall of that year, plaid, and the principal happened to notice that my skirt did not hit the bottom of my knees, which was the rule at the time, and so he made me come into the principal's office and made me kneel down to prove to me that my skirt did not hit the floor. And fortunately, I mean, I was humiliated. I was an A student. I never did anything wrong. Mm. And sure enough, the secretary there came to my defense and said, kilts are supposed to be worn a little shorter. And so I was able to wear what I was wearing. I was not sent home.
So now many dress codes have numbers of inches from the top of the knees, and many people have experienced rulers in terms of getting their skirts measured. And dress codes throughout the nation for school children of all ages, from kindergarten to high school, have measurements in them, all different kinds of things. It's also interesting that you mentioned kilts and plaids, because at one time, you know, the English made plaid illegal to wear. So,
Leslie in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Leslie.
Oh, hi. I wanted to talk about a job interview I had just yesterday, college teaching, part-time. And I've been teaching for 20 years. I normally dress the way I like to dress. In fact, people comment how they love the way I dress. But at this particular school, they told me I was dressed inappropriately. I was wearing an orange primary color with crop pants, sandals. I was told that at this school, we dress corporate, either a pantsuit or a skirt or a dress. Fortunately, I still got the job, but it was brought to my attention three times.
What did they most object to? Was it the sandals?
Well, I guess the color was too bright. I was wearing cropped pants. It wasn't corporate.
So color, the kind of policing of color is something that we wouldn't think happens. But in my work, I've seen so many dress codes that are about color, like certain colors are allowed, and you can imagine what they are, brown, black, dark blue, and other colors just seem to be not allowed. Huh. Orange. Some places really don't like prints. You know, again, plaid, stripes, things like that.
Orange is the new black, but I guess that's a different show. Leslie, thank you very much. That's a surprising story. We're going to take a break in a second, take some more calls, keep talking to Ruth Ann Robeson, author of Dressing Constitutionally. I just wanted to finish the thought on going topless. If men can go topless and women cannot, does that violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment?
Courts have generally said no. So there are some places that actually have tried to criminalize men going topless, and those have not been upheld. Courts have said that's not rational. Men can go topless at the beach or on a boardwalk at night or things like that. Or while jogging. But for women, generally courts have said men and women are differently situated in this instance. Men's breasts and women's breasts are not the same at all. And one court says that's as obvious as water is wet, even though many men's breasts are bigger than some women's breasts, things like that. Interestingly, some statutes have started to have kind of exceptions for breastfeeding, which I find interesting because that's, of course, the only time at which men's breasts and women's breasts are inherently different, the ability to lactate.
We'll continue in a minute. We'll get into what kind of political expression you can literally wear on your sleeve. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. WNYC. By the way, if you're just getting your head around the mayoral race, we've been interviewing all the candidates all year, and we have aggregated those interviews together on a webpage, so you can go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show if you want to hear some of my conversations with mayoral hopefuls from a little earlier this year, if you're just now starting to figure out who you're going to vote for. We continue now with Ruth Ann Robeson, constitutional scholar and law professor at the CUNY School of Law. In her new book, Dressing Constitutionally, she tells us how the law sometimes clashes with what you wear. 212-433-WNYC for your stories. And our lines are just bursting, so let's hear from some more of our callers. Michael in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Yeah, back in 1993, Nirvana was, you know, big back then, and Kurt Cobain wore a dress on stage and all. And so a bunch of guys, after gym class, changed into dresses we borrowed from our girlfriends. And were called to the principal's office and promptly sent home afterwards.
And what did you think you were doing? Did you think you were cross-dressing? Did you think you were expressing a feminine side of yourself or something more mundane than that?
I think probably at the time it was something more along the, you know, punk rock ethic of sort of like, you know, fighting the establishment and, you know, things kids do to say, you know, I'm not like you, I'm have my own identity, even though five of us did it. You know, I think that's what it'd be.
Michael, thank you. Do you know the Kurt Cobain story?
Yes. And so one thing that really is interesting has to do with, you know, enforcement of gender codes of school children. And wearing skirts, women wearing skirts as well, whether they're short or not, as a kind of gender enforcement. And then really in the 70s, there were lots and lots and lots of cases about men's hair or boys' hair. And courts really had a very difficult time with that. One, in terms of rebellion, and did it even express anything? And two, lots of courts said, we won't be able to tell the difference between boys and girls if boys' hair is longer.
And let's hear another story from Michael on the Upper West Side. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. Some years ago, when I was a young teenager living in the village with my bike buddies, I was in the park wearing some cut-off jean shorts, and a cop decided that my shorts were too short. So I asked him how short was too short, and he said, 2 inches. So I went home, and I got the rest of the pants legs, and I pinned them back on, and I came back. And he saw me, and he got so angry that he dragged me into an office by the restroom and threatened to beat me up.
Oh, this is a guy with shorts that were deemed too short by the police. How short were they? How far down did
Nothing
they go?
Nothing was hanging out. They weren't that short.
All right. Thank you very much. Do you hear that story from
yes.
guys or never really?
Yes, and actually there's an incident that I talk about in the book, and you're kind of lucky that you weren't arrested and certainly lucky that you weren't beat up. But a man in Florida shopping at a Walmart, someone objected, called security, called police. He was then arrested for indecent exposure. He tried to represent himself and brought in the shorts in question and wore them for the judge. And the judge said that they were too short. And he appealed, again, representing himself. And the judge, those judges said, again, too short. So there is a way in which one can be too short. And interestingly as well, that would be indecent exposure, and then one could be adjudged a sex offender.
Ben in Windsor Terrace, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ben.
Hi. So I wanted to talk about an incident where I was shopping on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan, like Fifth Avenue and 16th Street or something. I don't know if to mention the name of the store. Mm-hmm. And I was prevented from – I was downstairs in the men's section. I'm someone who was assigned female at birth. I was trying on men's clothing. There were single stall dressing rooms. The dressing area was not labeled in any way as men or women or anything else. And I was prevented by three levels of managers from trying on the clothes in the store.
What did they say to you?
They decided what my gender was. And I tried to argue about the New York City human rights law, because in New York City we are...
Yes.
We do actually have protections around gender identity, which not everywhere in the country does. And they were not interested in that law. They were not interested in the possibility that they were breaking that law. Three levels of managers. They said that I had to go upstairs to the women's section to try on the clothes. And I work with a lot of transgender and gender nonconforming individuals in the work that I do. And I, in that time, was working with people who were much more vulnerable than me and were having very similar problems, and decided that it was important to try to stand up for myself and all the other people who struggle with this throughout the city all the time. And so I argued with them. I argued with three levels of managers, and I got absolutely nowhere.
Wow. I think this is the leading edge of this whole topic, given that, you know, transgender rights are much more prominent and out front as an issue than they ever were before, Professor.
And yes, you're exactly right that in New York we do have a human rights ordinance that includes gender identity. And I think the next step really is filing a complaint with the Human Rights Commission and having them investigate it and kind of look at it, because that's one of the ways in which change is made, both for customers and for employees.
Thank you for your call, Ben. Good luck. To what extent can the government control how people dress at school? You're right that a school recently tried to ban wristbands with a slogan, "I Heart Boobies," designed to promote breast cancer awareness. Were they successful?
No. And so the Third Circuit just issued an opinion that said the school could not ban those bracelets. And interestingly there, one of the standards is disruption and disruption of the school. And so the school argued that these bracelets were disruptive. They were disruptive because boys might giggle or boys might find it sexualized. And of course, throughout the litigation became really much more disruptive of anything that would have happened if they would have allowed it.
which reminds me of the famous case Tinker versus Des Moines, where the court ruled that students were allowed to wear black wristbands to protest the Vietnam War. Does the same idea apply?
Yes. And so that was black armbands, and they were talking about Vietnam War. And the court there, at least a majority of the court, found that that was expressive speech and that the school, in fact, was allowing other kinds of expressive speech, but then was not allowing that, and clearly found that the school had to allow that.
And this applies, that is, schools attempt to impose dress codes not just on the students. Right, Rachel, in Blairstown?
Hi.
Hi.
Our school has decided to impose a dress code on teachers starting this fall. There was a great deal of discussion between the board and our union, but unfortunately none of our suggestions were taken. But two of the most offensive things that are part of this new dress code for teachers, and believe me, I would like to say that, you know, professional teachers should certainly follow professional attire, but most teachers are adult enough and mature enough and professional enough to decide what that should be. And a few people shouldn't be, everybody shouldn't be punished for a few people. But the two new offensive parts of this dress code is that, are that female teachers are not allowed to wear anything sleeveless. And I'm not talking about spaghetti straps. I'm talking about like a cap sleeve, short, you know, shorter, thick sleeved blouse. And male teachers are not allowed to wear sweaters. And this might not seem too significant until you realize that our building has no air conditioning in it and gets up to 95 degrees, I would say, in some of the warmer months.
Wait, what's up with the sweaters?
The sweaters? I have no idea, but we also have no heat in the building, usually until sometime in November or until parents complain, and male teachers can't wear sweaters. I don't understand it.
Sounds like you've got a grievance on your hands, Rachel. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the Blairstown, whichever school that is, coming up this fall. We've just got about 30, 40 seconds. Professor, what's the unifying principle here? Is it that you advocate that the government stay out of what we wear, but also never force us to wear anything?
Well, I think the unifying principle, and one of the things I was trying to investigate, really was how ubiquitous the government regulation of what we wear is, what's for sale in the shops, the kinds of things that we wear, and how that's influenced the Constitution or not. And so kind of thinking about the law whenever we dress.
Ruth Ann Robeson, CUNY Law Professor. Her new book is Dressing Constitutionally, Hierarchy, Sexuality, and Democracy, From Our Hairstyles to Our Shoes. It's in stores now. Thank you very much for joining. By the way, did you hear about that Olympic athlete who painted her fingernails rainbow to protest the Russian anti-gay law?
Expressive speech right there.
And you could write another whole book on Russian law and our clothing, but maybe you won't.
I'd have to do a lot of research.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.